is KMXT Kodiak 100.1 FM. KMXT is also in HD, and we have HD2 and HD3, and we're streaming live on the web at kmxt.org. It's currently overcast, 54 degrees, northwest winds of 10 miles per hour. Today we'll see a high near 60, winds out of the west of around 5 miles per hour, and tonight scattered showers, mostly cloudy with a low around 49 degrees. We'll see calm winds becoming northwest winds of around 5 miles per hour after midnight. Tomorrow, more scattered showers, mostly in the afternoon though, partly sunny throughout the day with a high near 58. Calm winds becoming east winds of around 5 miles per hour in the afternoon. And it looks like the rain is going to stick around for the weekend so far. Saturday, we could see heavy rain. A quick note to anyone trying to hike today, starting at 8 a.m., South Island trails on Near Island are closed until 8 p.m. due to quarry operations. We'll have local news after NPR headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Federal prosecutors are asking for a trial date in early January 2024 in their case against former President Donald Trump on charges that he sought to overturn his 2020 election loss. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports.
A trial date in January 2024 would come 3 years after the attempt to disrupt the peaceful transfer of power in Washington. More than 1,000 people have faced criminal charges for their role in the riot at the Capitol. Now, former President Trump is fighting an indictment that accuses him of conspiring to defraud the U.S. and conspiring to obstruct the certification in Congress. Prosecutor Molly Gaston says the DOJ case could take 4 to 6 weeks. She says a speedy jury trial is best for the American people. Trump will have several days to respond to the proposal. So far, his lawyers have signaled they want to delay the case until after the next presidential election, where Trump's the frontrunner for the GOP nomination. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
4 U.S. citizens have been moved from Iran's notorious Evin prison to house arrest as the U.S. and Iran finalize a deal to bring them home. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
U.S. officials call it an encouraging step, but say the 5 Americans should never have been detained in the first place. The White House has named 3 of them, Siam Aknamazi, Murad Tabaz, and Imad Shargi, but says 2 others wish to remain private. One, a woman, had already been shifted to house arrest. A National Security Council spokesperson says negotiations for their eventual release remain ongoing and are, quote, delicate. Iran has been seeking access to about $6 billion of its oil revenue stuck in South Korea. The U.S. is also likely to release some Iranian prisoners in exchange for the 5 Americans. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
In Ecuador, there is a state of emergency today after one of the country's leading presidential candidates was assassinated, leaving a political rally. As Jorge Valencia reports, troops have been deployed ahead of the presidential election later this month.
The candidate, Fernando Villavicencio, had publicly said he received death threats. He said it was in response to a promise to root out corruption. We're going to talk about the political mafia that other candidates don't want to talk about, Villavicencio recently told a local radio station. Late Wednesday, local time, he was fatally shot in the capital of Quito. Hours later, outgoing President Guillermo Lasso ordered the military onto the country's streets.
No vamos a retroceder.
We won't back down to criminals, Lasso said in an address. The Ecuadorian election will go on as scheduled August 20th. For NPR News, I'm Jorge Valencia.
Evacuations continue on the Hawaiian island of Maui, where at least 36 people have died in wildfires that have caused extensive devastation. Wall Street at the close, the Dow up 52, the Nasdaq up 15. This is NPR. Niger is topic A at a meeting of the 15-member Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS. Kate Bartlett reports the military junta, which seized power there 2 weeks ago, has already ignored a deadline to reinstate the deposed president.
In his opening remarks at the emergency summit in Abuja, Nigerian President and ECOWAS Chairman Bola Tinubu said it was important the group engage in dialogue and prioritize diplomatic relations. Last week, the group drew up plans for possible military intervention in Niger, but didn't carry them through. The junta shows no signs of backing down, refusing to free detained President Mohamed Bazoum despite calls for his unconditional release by the UN Secretary General. Just ahead of the summit, the junta named a new government with a civilian economist at its helm. Western powers have called for a return to constitutional rule, while the military governments in neighboring Mali and Burkina Faso have vowed to defend the junta. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett.
President Biden is calling on Congress to approve a $40 billion package of emergency funding for several initiatives. $24 billion of it is related to the war in Ukraine and includes security, economic, and humanitarian assistance. The request also includes funding for the U.S. southern border with Mexico. This involves border and migration security, shelter and migrant services, drug enforcement efforts, especially targeting fentanyl, and funds to boost immigration court needs, including judges. $12 billion of the $40 billion is meant for FEMA and natural disasters. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Kirsten Dobrath. Communities in the Aleutians East Borough are bracing for a revenue hit as the region's largest seafood processor builds a new facility outside of the borough. KUCB's Theo Greenlee has more.
Trident Seafoods operates the nation's largest fish processing plant in Accutan, a small island located in the Aleutians East Borough. But the seafood giant recently began construction on a new processing facility in Unalaska, which isn't part of the same borough. The new processor isn't set to open until at least 2027, but it has raised questions about the future of the Accutan plant.
We aren't interested in just walking away from the community of Accutan. They're really important to us.
Stephanie Moreland is an executive with the seafood company. She says they don't intend to cut ties with the community that's been at the center of their operation for decades.
I want to ensure that the community is in dialogue with us, understanding what our timeline is, why, and talking about the assets that we have in Accutan, thinking about what the future looks like for the village.
Multiple residents in Accutan have confirmed that Trident has held outreach events in their community about the plant's future. Aleutians East Borough Mayor Alvin Osterbach said in a statement that Trident has been an excellent partner for decades, and the borough does not want to see them leave Accutan. And he addressed a potential major hit to borough coffers, saying the seafood processor's departure will have a large financial impact on the borough and its communities. The Aleutians East Borough gets over half of its revenue from raw fish tax. Proprietary laws make it difficult to determine just how much of that comes from the Trident plant, but Trident dwarfs all other processors in the region. No matter Trident's plans, Mayor Osterbach says the borough is at work preparing a strategy regarding the economic impacts as they prepare for a potential Trident exit. Reporting from the Aleutians East Borough, I'm Theo Greenlee.
In other news, a federal judge Monday dismissed a lawsuit filed by the state of Alaska and its Economic Development Agency that challenged a 2021 Biden administration move to suspend oil leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. That's according to reporting by the Northern Journal. President Joe Biden, immediately after taking office, ordered a supplemental review of the federal government's refuge leasing program and directed a suspension of development-related activity while the review played out. A similar action followed a few months later from Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, and the Supplemental Environmental Review has not yet been completed. Governor Mike Dunleavy's administration and the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, or ADA, both challenged those decisions, joined by the North Slope Borough and the two Alaska Native corporations from the area. U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason, in a 74-page order Monday, dismissed the case. Officials from the state and Dunleavy's administration did not immediately respond to a request for comment. And the U.S. Forest Service says it will build 25 new recreation cabins in the Tongass and Chugach National Forests. The cabins won't be all built at once. The first seven cabins are out for bid and will be constructed next summer. That first wave of new cabins will be spread across southeast Alaska and the Kenai Peninsula. They're all on the road system except for one, which is a rebuild of a cabin at the Annan Bear Observatory near Wrangell that was crushed by a tree during a storm over the winter. Don Collingsworth is a deputy director of Recreation Lands and Minerals for the Alaska region. She says the Forest Service received over 1,000 comments on where the cabins should go.
Where we're siting these cabins is really where the public would like to see them, and because that just means they're going to get more use, which is the goal.
Collingsworth says the new cabin sites are more accessible than many of the existing ones, which are only reachable by boat or plane or extreme hikes.
What we wanted to make sure that we're doing is providing cabins that are more accessible and reach sort of a broader cross-section of the public who would like to recreate, but perhaps don't have the physical capabilities of taking a long hike up a mountain.
Congress appropriated the money for the cabins. Over $14 million for the years-long project is coming from the bipartisan infrastructure law passed in 2021. The Forest Service is also getting around $3.7 million from the National Forest Foundation for the cabins project. After building the first seven cabins next summer, the agency plans to build 18 more over the coming summers. They don't know where all 18 will go, but they plan to have at least one in every district. That's eight districts in the Tongass and three districts in the Chugach. Rachel Weston is the regional recreation planner for the Forest Service.
The cabins that were selected for this first round were the furthest along in the planning process, so they were kind of the most ready for construction. The remaining cabin locations are still being ground truthed to determine if it's viable to put a cabin in that spot, and the districts are still working through that.
Districts with higher public demand might get more than one cabin depending on the viability of the locations. Forest Service cabins in Alaska rent for between $35 and $75 a night. And nearly 800 cruise ships passengers will come through Kodiak this week. The Roald Amundsen is the first of two cruise ships that will visit the island today, followed by the Hanseatic Nature tomorrow. Both ships have also visited the island earlier this year. This summer is Kodiak's busiest cruise ship season since 2019, although it's starting to wind down. After the Hanseatic Nature disembarks from Kodiak on Friday evening, the island won't see its next ship till mid-September. Final cruise ship of the season is scheduled for October 15th when the 670-passenger regatta calls in Kodiak. And black cod could be a growing problem for salmon hatcheries across the state. As KFSK's Thomas Copeland reports, climate change is warming the Gulf of Alaska and bolstering black cod populations.
Salmon hatcheries aren't for the faint-hearted. Ryan Schumann runs this hatchery in Cake for the Northern Southeast Regional Aquaculture Association, or ENSRA. Once enough chum swim up Gunnock Creek, Schumann seals their fate.
We'll close that gate and hit the winch button and force them into the building.
Next comes what Schumann calls the shocker.
Okay, so you electrocute them to stun them?
Yes, so females and males respectively. You can see one right next to the other there. And how he's got those gnarly teeth and she's just kind of got this cute little round head.
Finally, a bash on the head with a mini metal baseball bat and it's lights out. The females slide down one chute and out come their bright orange eggs. Returns that day were okay, but across the whole season, they are not. The reason? Not enough four-year-olds. And most chums spawn when they're four. The goal was to collect 20 million eggs this season. They've ended up with less than half of that. And Schumann thinks he knows why. When the four-year-olds were released from here as fry back in 2020, they immediately came face to face with a mortal enemy, juvenile black cod.
The water surface just started frothing and popping with these juvenile black cod that seemingly came out of nowhere and just frothed the surface, eating these fish.
Those black cod, also called sable fish, were hungry over near Sitka too. Ben Adams is ENSRA's research manager. In 2020, he took a video during a dive underneath the rearing pens at Metavigi Hatchery on Baranoff Island.
And we got in the water and it was just remarkably dark at first was kind of the first thought that went into my head. So I'm starting to feel kind of disoriented and a little bit of vertigo. And finally, what I recognized that I was inside of this giant school of juvenile blacktop where the fish were kind of swimming in a big vortex around me.
So Adam's got a special permit to drag the pens 6 miles out and then release the chum. But was that enough to save the salmon from becoming black cod dinner? Well, now Adams isn't optimistic. You see, most chum returns to Medavigi come in later than in cake. But you can predict how many four-year-olds will return by looking at how many three-year-olds came back the year before. And last year, the return rate was tiny. Just 0.04%.
0.04% is horrific. It was abysmal. I mean, 2022, it just tanked to the worst that we'd ever seen.
Those fall returns are a late season lifeline to fishermen, but this year, the fisheries around Medavigi will have to be limited. So, why were there so many black cod in 2020? Dana Hanselman is the director of Auk Bay Laboratories, a federal program which studies commercial fish species. He says sablefish spawn in deep water, and then the larvae need help getting out of there.
And so it's incumbent upon the circulation patterns to be able to transport those larvae into the nursery areas that are in bays and, you know, coastal areas. In warmer years, there's often increased circulation that moves them faster to shore.
Hanselman says that as water temperatures in the Gulf of Alaska have risen this past decade, so too have black cod numbers.
So every year class since 2014 has been at least twice average. And then some of them, like 2019, look to be at least five times bigger than average.
So 2019 into 20, there were five times as many black cod as there have been on average.
Exactly.
Plus, these fish are not picky eaters.
Sablefish are a voracious and opportunistic predator. And by opportunistic, I mean they'll eat anything. They'll eat it quickly.
Now, hatchery managers Schumann and Adams predict that next year's returns will be much better. But if water temperatures continue to rise, black cod could pose an increasing threat to salmon hatcheries and the fishermen who rely on them. Back in Cake, though, Schumann says that for the salmon, it's just another peril in an unforgiving life cycle.
That's a cruel old way to go, but I suppose they're going to die anyway, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They're either going to be eaten by a bear or a seal or an eagle or...
Or gobbled up by more and more black cod. From Cake, I'm Thomas Copeland.
Major changes could be coming to Juneau's waterfront. The city's planning commission has approved Huna Totem Corporation's application to build a culture and science center, retail space, and underground parking. KTOO's Katie Anastas has more.
Huna Totem is calling the $150 million project Auk Landing. It includes a new cruise ship dock, a culture and science center, retail space, and underground parking. Last month, the planning commission approved the dock, but they stopped short of permitting the rest of the project, saying they wanted more information and public input. On Tuesday, the commission got that public input, and it was mostly in favor. Kerry Crocker leads the local International Longshore and Warehouse Union. Their workers moor and unmoor ships at the docks downtown.
These are good-paying jobs. They're living wage jobs, provide pension, benefits, health care. And the additional work opportunity with this project is considerable for us.
The approved proposal includes a culture and science center, built with help from Sea Alaska Heritage Institute and Gold Belt. Carla Kasalukin, a Huna Totem shareholder, said Auk Landing would go beyond preserving culture.
It lays the foundation for economic empowerment and sustainable development, not just for the city of Juneau and its residents, but also within our Indigenous community.
Those who spoke against the project, like downtown resident Steve Krall, were concerned about pollution and other negative impacts of tourism.
The basic problem facing us now as citizens is not that tourism is wrong or bad, but there's too much of it, and we've neglected to manage it in a reasonable way.
But Fred Parody, Huna Totem's chief operating officer, said the project would help reduce congestion on South Franklin Street. It's on the other side of the waterfront from the rest of the cruise ship docks.
Shifting 125,000 people from one side of town to the other is significant in terms of pedestrian traffic flow.
Commissioner Eric Peterson said the location meant buses could avoid much of downtown on their way to the Mendenhall Glacier.
It lowers impacts to our community, especially with the buses not driving through town. And it basically provides a great way to unload a ship.
The commission voted to approve the conditional use permit application in a 7-1 vote. The Juneau Assembly still needs to approve a lease of the tidelands before Huna-Totum can build a dock. The Planning Commission's decision on the dock has been appealed by Juneau resident Carla Hart. The Assembly will either accept or reject that appeal at its next meeting. In Juneau, I'm Katie Anastas.
A new solar energy project in Galena promises to help the Yukon River community reduce its dependence on expensive diesel-fired power generation. Tribal officials worked with the city and school district to complete the project, and they're now considering building a bigger solar energy facility. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Work on the 50-kilowatt solar array was completed last month, and it's now being hooked up to the small grid operated by the city of Galena's electric utility. Loudoun Tribal Administrator Brooke Sanderson says if all goes well, the solar panels will begin generating power next week.
It's definitely an exciting project for the community.
Exciting because the new system will displace diesel fuel that up until now has been the only way to generate electricity in the western interior community of about 400 people. The cost of diesel has been rising steadily in recent months, and it's even more expensive because it's brought to the community by barge up the Yukon River.
The reduction in diesel fuel is hopefully going to be really huge for the city of Galena because that's a major cost they have to incur every year.
That's why Galena utility customers pay more than 72 cents per kilowatt hour, about three times what Golden Valley Electric Association members pay, and about five times what Anchorage-based Chugach Electric members pay. And even though solar panels won't produce much electricity during the winter, they'll make up for that in the spring, summer, and fall.
People always argue, oh, well, what are you going to do during the winter months?
Dave Messier is Rural Energy Coordinator for the Tanana Chiefs Conference.
And we tell them, well, the same thing that the community has been doing during the winter months for the last 50, 60 years, run diesel generators. But during the summer, at least, we've got a ton of free energy that's hitting the surface of the earth.
Messier's been helping the Loudoun Tribe get funding for the project as part of Tanana Chief's larger efforts to help rural communities reduce their use of diesel with reliable, easy-to-maintain, renewable energy systems equipped with backup battery power.
Up in Hughes, we have a system that's been running in diesels off for portions of the year for periods of up to 12 hours, and it's in its second year.
Sanderson says if the 50-kilowatt project in Galena performs well, it'll serve as a stepping stone to a larger 1.2-megawatt solar array that the tribe wants to build. And tribal officials learned last month that the Federal Department of Energy awarded a $2.25 million grant to help pay for the project, which is expected to save 95,000 gallons of diesel annually.
The smaller scale project, the idea is that it would inform some of the management decisions on the large scale project because this is new.
We're excited to see this pilot project get up and running and see how it actually goes.
Tim Kalki is General Manager of Sustainable Energy for Galena, Alaska, or SEGA, a nonprofit jointly run by the Tribe, City of Galena, and City School District.
And then as winter and next spring come about, help us really make more firm decisions for the larger project.
Kalki and others in the community established SEGA 9 years ago to find alternatives to diesel fire generators that the military handed over to the city after it closed Galena Air Force Station in 2008. He says they jointly decided to build a biomass energy plant that burns locally harvested wood to heat the former base that now houses the Galena Interior Learning Academy, or GILA, a residential vocational school. And he says the success of that project and the solar pilot project may build community support for taking the next step on a bigger solar project.
You know, really involves all of the main entities in the community between the tribe, the city, the school, SEGA, and the people. Because ultimately, the individuals who have their roots deep within the community are the folks who are going to have to keep it up and running.
Sanderson agrees and said that's another benefit the project would bring. It'll enable young people to learn about solar energy and then get good-paying jobs in the community they grew up in operating the facility. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Stocks rise on inflation news. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer with the Marketplace Minute. The Consumer Price Index for July was up 3.2% from a year ago, a bit below expectations, making investors happy. But core inflation, stripping out volatile food and energy prices, that was up 4.7%. Applications for unemployment benefits rose a bit more than expected over the past week. 248,000 people filed for unemployment for the first time, an increase of 21,000. A new report from a Swiss insurance company says a series of severe thunderstorms in the U.S. caused insured losses of $34 billion in the first half of this year, the highest number ever for 6 months. Swiss Re blames what it calls urban sprawl into the wilderness. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer with the Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon. It is Thursday, August 10th. Sunrise today was 6:23 a.m. Sunrise or sunset tonight will be 10:05 p.m. That gives us 15 hours and 42 minutes of daylight. That's a loss of 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Sunrise tomorrow is 6:26 a.m. Record high for today was 72 degrees in 1971 and 2009. Record low was 38 degrees back in 1970. And looking over at our marine weather, Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles today. West winds of 15 knots with seas to 3 feet. Tonight, west winds of 15 knots with seas to 3 feet. And tomorrow, variable winds of 10 knots, becoming east winds of 20 knots in the afternoon with seas to 3 feet. Over in the Shelikof, there's a small craft advisory Friday. Today, west winds of 15 knots with seas to 3 feet. Tonight, variable winds of 10 knots with seas to 2 feet. And tomorrow, variable winds of 10 knots becoming northeast winds of 25 knots in the afternoon, seas to 3 feet, building to 5 feet in the afternoon. We have time for a few community announcements. There's an estate planning workshop that Saturday, August 12th, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. in the Kodiak Public Library's multipurpose room. Interested in wills and estate planning but not sure where to start? You can join for an informative workshop with local attorney Andrew Ott to understand the steps and options in pursuing this important planning process. RSVP is at Kodiak at alaskacf.org. And Kodiak Kids Pink Salmon Derby, that's August 12th and 13th, Saturday and Sunday from 10:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. It's at the mouth of the Buskin River. Welcome for kids ages 3 to 15. Registration is required. Hot dogs will be served. All state fishing rules apply. Participants can only enter one of the 2 days, and the winner will be announced at the end of the derby. You can contact Drew for more information. That number is 907-539-1422. And there is a Kodiak Island Borough work session scheduled for tonight. That's 6:30 p.m. If you have any questions, you can contact the Borough Clerk's Office at 907-486-9310. And now a word from Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement number 28, date issued 10 a.m. on August 9th. There will be a 105-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Thursday, August 10th to 9 p.m. Monday, August 14th in the following areas. In the Halibut Bay, Sturgeon, and Outer Karluk sections of the Southwest Kodiak District, the Northwest Kodiak District, except for the Uyak Bay and Inner Uganic Bay sections, will remain closed. The Northeast Kodiak District, Eastside Kodiak District, and the southwest of Fognak, northwest of Fognak, Raspberry Strait, and northeast of Fognak sections of the Fognak District. There will be a 57-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Thursday, August 10th to 9 p.m. Saturday, August 12th in the following areas. In the southeast of Fognak, Duck Bay, Iziut Bay, and Outer Katoy Bay sections of the Fognak District. The Outer Iqaluk section of the southwest Kodiak District, and the Cape Alitak, Humpy Deadman, Alitak Bay, Mosier Bay and Olga Bay sections of the Alitak District, and the Spearden Bay Special Harvest Area. Closed waters are expanded until further notice in that portion of the southwest Fognak section of the Fognak District within 1/2 nautical mile of the beach near the stream terminus of Molina Creek, stream number 252105, between 58 degrees 10 north latitude and 58 degrees 11 north latitude. As previously announced, Cost recovery fisheries began in Katoy Bay Special Harvest Area on August 5th, and fishing opportunities in the Duck Bay, Iduit Bay, Inner Katoy Bay, and Outer Katoy Bay sections will depend on the ability of the Regional Aquaculture Association to meet cost recovery needs, and all cost recovery information may be obtained by calling 486-6559. Until further notice, within the Kodiak area, only that portion of the northwest and southwest Kodiak districts south of the latitude of Cape Kuliak, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by Per Sangir in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak area salmon statistical chart detailed in commercial salmon fishing regulations and statistical charts. Harvest strategies and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game office. And, of course, the most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour recorder phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. And this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the midday report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
Support for KMXT comes from GCI. Since 1979, GCI has invested in the future of Alaska. GCI is committed to keeping schools and healthcare facilities connected for Alaskans. More information at gci.com/business.